This is the Morning Magazine for March 14th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear from a neuroscientist about the risks and rewards of daylight savings time. And we'll look into what's causing delays in rebuilding efforts in Louisville. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC News headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown, followed by a public affair. On today's program, host Frank Dubofsky talks with David Farnan, Boulder's Director of Library and Arts. They'll discuss the current state of the library system and the possible switch to a sustainable funding model called a library district. And as always on Monday morning, it's Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. Then at 9:30, Cameron Henderson will be in the Boulder studio to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead this morning, but first, a look at local and regional headlines with KGNU's Ellie Stuckrath.
Colorado lawmakers have advanced a bill that would create a new tax credit for small businesses and local residents spending money on advertising and underwriting in local news outlets. The bill aims to support local media and businesses that have struggled during the pandemic. The tax credit will allow local businesses to reach larger audiences while supporting the local media ecosystem. Businesses that have 50 or fewer employees would be eligible to receive up to $2,500 in tax credits for advertising or underwriting expenses. Individual taxpayers can receive as much as $250 in tax credit from spending money on local news memberships, subscriptions, or donations. Colorado Representative Lisa Cutter, who introduced the bill, said, "This is one way we can help local media, and in the process, help our communities grow stronger." The Colorado State House of Representatives effectively passed the Reproductive Health Equity Act over the weekend after their longest debate in modern history. KGNU's Jack Armstrong has more.
Colorado's State House of Representatives spent roughly an entire day debating the Reproductive Health Equity Act, lasting from Friday morning all the way into 10 a.m. on Saturday. The bill, also known as HB 1279, declares that every individual has a fundamental right to use or refuse contraception. Every pregnant individual has a fundamental right to continue the pregnancy and give birth, or to have an abortion. And a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus does not have independent or derivative rights under the laws of the state. Though the House of Representatives has a heavy majority of Democratic representatives, procedural tradition dictates that the House debate the bill until reconciliation. The Republican representatives stalled the session by reading their excess of materials slowly on the House floor. The debate, which concluded with a preliminary voice vote on Saturday morning, has the bill effectively passing, though it will face the formality of a third reading for final passage today. The bill bans government interference with the reproductive rights on all levels, at a time in which many Republican-led states are passing legislation to severely restrict access to safe and legal abortions. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
1 year after its approval, 73 colleges and universities in Colorado have been approved to receive over $516 million under the American Rescue Plan. That's according to the office of Congressman Joe Neguse. The American Rescue Plan provides colleges and universities across the country with aid in hopes of providing some economic relief amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. Department of Education's Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund is in charge of distributing this aid, one of the largest one-time deployment of funds to higher education establishments. According to a survey conducted by the American Council on Education, this aid has already helped 93% of colleges to provide direct financial support to students at risk of dropping out, and 70% of colleges to continue to employ faculty, staff, and other employees otherwise at risk of unemployment. $162 million of the aid coming to Colorado is for community colleges, and nearly $144 million is for minority-serving institutions, or MSIs. Front Range Community College will receive almost $30 million, Colorado State University will receive $50 million, and the University of Colorado will receive $51 million in aid. Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission voted against granting new drilling permits to Kerr McGee to develop new wells in the community of Firestone. The environmental group 350 Colorado says this marks the first time the state's oil and gas regulators have ever denied a drilling permit. Regulators cited a 2019 law that prohibits drilling within 2,000 feet of homes and schools as the basis for the permit rejection. High gas prices are forcing delivery and car share drivers to decline more orders and deliver shorter distances. Some delivery driving apps, including Uber, are implementing surcharges of 35 to 45 cents on orders to try and help drivers compensate for gas. Uber said that these charges are temporary and will go directly to the delivery drivers. However, drivers are still making changes to ensure they minimize their gas intake as much as possible, including only accepting orders within a few mile radius or reducing the number of hours they work. The Waiting Room Gallery on Larimer Street in Denver's Rhino District is no longer showcasing artwork after an individual broke in and stole artwork on February 24th. The individual stole 8 pieces from the second floor that were worth a total of $27,000. None of the works were covered by insurance. The gallery's curator, Dan Drossman, asked the community to keep an eye out for the stolen artwork, images of which are posted online at thewaitingroomgallery.com. In today's weather, the National Weather Service forecasts a high of 54 degrees today in Boulder with a low of 32. Tomorrow we'll see more sun with a high of 66 degrees, but temperatures will begin to drop Wednesday, with rain expected in the evening and overnight snow showers that continue into Thursday. Denver should see similar weather with a high of 56 degrees today and a forecasted high of 69 degrees tomorrow, with rain and snow expected Wednesday night into Thursday. Temperatures are expected to reach 56 degrees in Fort Collins today. Outside the Boulder studios, it's 34 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Ellie Stuckrath.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Over the weekend, Colorado lost an hour and sprung forward into daylight savings time. Colorado currently has 2 time change bills up for consideration. One bill calls for the state to adopt year-round daylight savings time. The other bill wants year-round standard time. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke to Dr. Karen Johnson, a sleep medicine specialist and associate professor of neurology at UMass Chan Medical School, Bay State. She says before we make any decisions, we should consider why we have time zones in the first place.
So, you know, the first is why do we have time zones? And that was really the railroad companies. So it used to be that everyone just looked above their head and said, sun is up high at noon, and that was their time. So if you were driving across the country, every town would have its own time. So if you were on a bus, you could go through 5 different time zones. And, you know, one would be 12:03, and every degree longitude that you go, the sun is shifted 4 minutes over. So, you know, people would look up at their sun and they would be off. And so it caused, you know, as we started moving more, it just started causing mass confusion. And then finally in 1966 was the Uniform Time Act. So that's why we have time zones. The idea in terms of why going to daylight savings time, one was some people thought you could get more out of your day. And the other issue that came up is, do we save more energy? And more recent studies looking at energy have actually found more energy use on daylight savings time. It takes more energy to warm up your house or your business on cold mornings. And the longer you're out and awake in the evening, we tend to turn on that air conditioner more.
So you study the human biological clock and how it's affected by time change. What have you found?
When we change the clocks, but don't change where the sun is in the sky, our hormones that sort of tell us where our clock is change only by 2 minutes after daylight savings time. So despite the hour clock change, our bodies do not adjust. And it affects things like our cognition and our productivity. So it really has these sort of long-term consequences that we could really lessen greatly just by being always on standard time, which is more matched to that sun time in the sky.
I mean, how much of our society is actually in tune with our biological clock?
So on average, people lose about 19 minutes of sleep per day during the whole daylight savings time period. When we have to get up for work by like 7 a.m. or go to school by 7 a.m., those people tend to lose about 36 minutes on average of sleep a day. And the problem is this really disproportionately affects certain people. So you're much more likely to have an early start time if you're a minority, if you have a lower social economic status, you know, school children tend to have to get up early. And one of the set of people that have the hardest time getting up early is teenagers. And this is why one of the other main public policies about sleep that's out there is called Start School Later. They have found that if schools start only at 8:30 in the morning instead of earlier, those kids get that little extra sleep. They're more aligned with sort of their own body's rhythm, and they're less affected by these things. And so schools that do start later, those students have higher academic achievement, less tardies and less missed days at school, less delinquency activities and you know, getting into trouble. So really that mix of letting us get the sleep we need and being more aligned can really help. So we have two options. One, we can change society so that we can start work late. Then it doesn't matter as much, or we can stop changing the clocks.
So you're saying the extra 20 minutes actually do make a difference?
You know, it sounds like nothing, but it is huge. And it really, so if we look at, for example, cancer risk, for every 5 degrees more west from the point at where the sun is overhead at noon, we have a 3% increased risk of cancer. So if you are a full hour off from where you're aligned, that's a 12% increased risk of cancer. So little bits of time, you know, cause health effects. They affect how we can think and our productivity. One big thing that's, I think, important for Colorado is they, you know, you do have bills there that are trying to promote time zone change. And if permanent daylight savings time is picked in Colorado, parts of Colorado would still be dark at 8:38 in the morning, and 100 days of the year would have sunrise after 8 a.m. And so people think, oh, I like late summers, but people really don't like dark mornings. It has been tried and failed before in the U.S. and other places and ended both because of things like increased school children deaths at their bus stops in the morning, as well as increase in mood disorders and stress and other sort of health problems that have increased. So while it sounds good, especially if we phrase it as, do you want summertime or wintertime? When it's actually been done, we find that, you know, people do worse. And history has shown it. We don't want to repeat again. So we do want to end time change, but it's really important that we do it in the healthiest and safest way, which is standard time. And that doesn't even take an act of Congress. It's already pre-approved. Any state can just vote to go on standard time, and it can be done.
Dr. Johnson is a sleep medicine specialist and associate professor of neurology at UMass Chan Medical School, Bay State. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
The Marshall Fire destroyed more than 1,000 homes when it ripped through Louisville, Superior, and unincorporated Boulder County in late December, sending thousands of Coloradans headlong into an urgent search for an affordable place to live. Now that the dust has settled, all of those families are thinking about rebuilding what was lost. And it's going to be expensive, especially with the brand new climate-friendly building codes Louisville instituted last October. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies spoke with Denver Post reporter Noelle Phillips about the fire's impact on our housing market, the cost of a green rebuild, and how Louisville residents are feeling about those new building codes now that it's wildfire survivors who will be footing the bill.
I think everybody who lives in the Front Range knows what our housing situation is like, and that rent is sky high. Houses, the home values, if you're a homeowner, just skyrocket, and you just see the value going up and up and up. You know that it's hard to find a place to rent, and it's really competitive. And so on December 30th, when the Marshall Fire ripped through Superior, Louisville, and parts of unincorporated Boulder County, it took out 1,084 residential properties. And so that's more than 1,000 homes in one community that's already expensive to live in. And it's devastating to people's personal lives. It's devastating to the housing market.
So I'm thinking about also the median home price in Louisville, right? We're looking at over $800,000.
Correct. These are nice houses.
Yeah.
But not everybody, when people hear that, they think, oh, these are a bunch of rich people. That's not necessarily the case, because there's a lot of people who bought their homes in the 90s when the communities first started being developed, and now they're retired. That's their life savings.
Yeah. So what does this look like for that retired couple or that family who lost their home? Like, what did people tell you? How are they handling this?
It's just devastating. Whenever I interview a family who lost a home, it's a very long phone conversation. They're very open about sharing. I always ask people, tell me about your home and what made it special. And it's just really neat to hear, I loved the peach tree. I have saved enough peaches to have 12 peach pies, one every month until next harvest season. We had 400 bottles of wine in our wine cellar that we'd been collecting since the 90s. We had a great backyard for our kids. Like, it's just like people loved their homes and they were really comfortable there. They lived near their work. They lived near their children's schools. And then everything's gone and it's just so painful. And then there, on top of that, there's so much uncertainty. I mean, you can't rebuild until the property is cleared of all the ash and debris, and that hasn't started yet. We're 2 months out from the fire, and the stuff's still laying in the ground in piles, and they don't know exactly when that's going to start, because that contracting process has now turned messy. So everything is a mess.
Did people find that they were underinsured? Or, like, I mean, I feel like if my house burned down today, I don't know if my insurance would cover it.
Probably wouldn't, Bree. Since I've reported the story, I tell everybody I know that's a homeowner, go get your insurance double checked. Underinsurance is a huge problem. Every single person that I've interviewed says, I don't have enough money in my insurance policy to rebuild my house in today's housing market. And that's coming from people who redid their insurance. So what's happening is the insurance companies, when you call, will say, Noelle, we recommend you buy this much coverage. It's called dwelling coverage, or coverage A in industry lingo. And so they might say it would take $300,000 to rebuild your house in today's market. So we're going to give you a policy for $300,000. A lot of families said, we asked for more and we're told, nah, no, that's enough. Well, the Colorado Home Builders Association estimates for a 2,000 square foot house, it's, I think, $300 to $325 a square foot to rebuild. So my husband and I live in a 2,000 square foot in Arvada, and we did, that's like $700,000. We don't have $700,000. We couldn't sell our house for $700,000. So it's this like unprecedented, like super expensive housing market where there's a labor shortage, supply chain delays, labor materials or lumber's through the roof. So it's just expensive to build a house. And then all these folks were like, we trusted our insurance agent to give us a proper quote and to tell us how much we needed. And now we don't have enough. Yeah. And most people believe that they are hundreds of thousands of dollars short.
Wow. So one of the big barriers in front of people in this situation in particular is that there's this new set of green building codes that Louisville implemented last year. Can you explain what those are and why wildfire survivors turned on them kind of pretty quickly?
Yeah. So in October, Louisville City Council became the first city in Colorado to pass these updated 2021 green building codes. They have some fancy bureaucratic name, but I just leave that out of my stories, and I'll leave this out of, that out of this conversation because it's dry. But essentially, there's a requirement for net zero greenhouse gas emissions from your house. So every greenhouse gas element you release, you need to like minimize it and negate it somewhere else. So these codes have like require like the most expensive modern energy efficient windows, the most energy efficient heat pumps, air conditioning units, top grade insulation, electric vehicle plugs, charging stations in your house. You have to have solar, either solar panels or buy credits and buy into a solar farm. And that helps you get to that net zero limit. And so no one's built a house under these codes, so they don't, nobody knows what it takes.
The actual cost, probably.
The actual cost. So the city really wanted to keep these codes in place. And I think, you know, if we look at it and not be partial to any side, you're like, well, green building codes were created to prevent greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gases heat the planet. Global warming is causing more frequent and intense wildfires, which is what happened in Louisville to have this devastating wildfire in December. And so like they're in this cycle and like it's a great goal. And before the fire, people in Louisville are like, yeah, we should do this. But then the fire wiped out 1,084 homes. And all of a sudden, and people are underinsured. And they're like, we don't have enough money to build our house back to what it was. And now we've got to do these building code upgrades. And that's going to add to the price.
Do we have any sense of how much this is going to cost?
The city commissioned a study from the, I can't remember the name. It was like Pacific Northwest something laboratory. It's a laboratory that falls under the U.S. Department of Energy. They did an analysis and they had two home builders who do green building, and they gave out an estimate of how much more this would add to the cost. But then the Home Builders Association and other builders in town are giving different amounts of what it will add to the cost. So you've got everything from, well, it'll add about $7,000 to $20,000 to $100,000. We don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But it's a scary proposition if you already think, I don't have enough money to rebuild my house. So it's made people really upset. Ultimately, Louisville decided we're going to allow people to opt out. And their staff is like writing a policy now on how fire victims can opt out of these green building codes. Because you, like, if your house didn't get destroyed in the Marshall Fire and it burns down this week, you'll probably still be subject to the green building codes, which you can see that being a problem too, right? And so like how that will work, and then city council will come back and vote on it.
What do you think other communities might take away from this when they consider green building codes? Because I mean, this is something we are going to be consistently dealing with. What can we take away from this situation in Louisville?
Well, I think these green building codes are going to become more and more common, especially in a state like Colorado, where we have the wildfires. Denver's air quality is rotten. And I feel like more and more cities are going to be doing this. And in most cases, we hope that a wildfire doesn't destroy an entire or a large portion of a town. Yeah. Like it did Superior and Louisville. I've had people say, though, just look at Telluride, Aspen, Vail, Steamboat. Look at how vulnerable those places are to wildfire. This could happen there. I had one guy who's like a national expert on the debris cleanup. And he goes, I go skiing in Colorado. I see the beetle kill. I know what that risk is.
It's just like almost a matter of time.
That's what some people think. Mm-hmm.
Well, Noelle Phillips, thank you so much.
Yeah, glad to help explain this to everybody.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Ellie Stuckrath, Jack Armstrong, Alexis Kenyon, Bree Davies, and the rest of the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then it's a public affair with Frank Dubofsky. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.